Steve Turner is the respected music journalist and biographer who's written for Rolling Stone and New Musical Express. He has written books about Eric Clapton, U2, Van Morrison, and the Beatles, including the book A Hard Day's Right, which is a look at the people and events that inspired the Beatles' lyrics, and we're talking to him from his home in West London. Hello, Steve. Thanks for talking with us. We're focusing on Revolver for this conversation, and I'm wondering, as you did your research and have studied the Beatles over the years, what it is about the Revolver moment that represents such a big change in how the Beatles went about writing their music lyrically and musically?
I suppose it's a product of the times. It seems to be the album that straddles their kind of beat music period, if you like, and the more self-consciously artistic music that was studio-based that came later in their career. I mean, it straddles those two movements in their career. And it was just a very exciting time for them because they were coming very open to new ideas in art and in literature, and their heads were kind of buzzing, and they were just about to come off the road forever, as we now know. And, you know, Paul was going to the theatre, he was going to art galleries. John wasn't getting out as much. George was getting into Indian religion. And they were just kind of excited about all this stuff and a bit disenchanted about touring. I was just working on a book called The Gospel According to the Beatles, and I hadn't realised how early on their disenchantment set in, the disenchantment with touring and with Beatlemania. I mean, as early as 64, they're kind of complaining about it. And so 64, 65, 66, they're gradually getting more and more fed up with touring and more interested in what they could do in the studio.
Can you take a stab at describing a little bit more about the scene that they were sampling? You know, you mentioned in your book the hippie scene in America and the avant-garde scene in London. Could you talk a little bit more about what they were absorbing, do you think?
I'm not sure how familiar they were with the hippie scene in America at that time. I mean, George visited San Francisco in 1967, and I think Paul visited in 1967 a little bit earlier than George, but both of them, I think, only for a day at the most. They would be familiar with stuff going on in the more of the East Coast hippie thing through Indica Books, which is a bookshop run by Miles, as everybody called him, Barry Miles, as he's better known for books he's written recently, including many years from now, the Paul McCartney's book. Miles ran this kind of independent avant-garde bookstore, and there was also an art gallery called Indica, and the Beatles were picking up books from this store, including underground newspapers from the States. So they would have been familiar with the Barclay Barb and the East Village Other and papers like that. So that they were getting in touch with those sort of ideas. But then the English scene was a little bit different. I think they were more in touch with, or particularly Paul, in fact, more in touch with the sort of avant-garde, mainly European-influenced avant-garde scene in London of the times. Robert Fraser's Art Gallery, Luciano Berio, John Cage, musicians, some of them coming to London, maybe giving lectures, giving recitals, and again, probably Paul more than the others would go along. George had met Ravi Shankar, that was a big influence for him, and he joined the Asian Music Circle in London.
But the world was a much broader place than now, so we can't presume that they were easily able to be aware of trends and such outside their travel circle, really.
Well, I think because they were traveling, they were more aware than most. I mean, now with the internet, I mean, you can be in touch with anything happening around the world, and you don't need to be a traveler to get in touch with those things. But they, for their generation, they had a great advantage because they were moving around. You know, they were going to India and Japan and Australia and New York and Los Angeles, so that they were very widely travelled for people in their early 20s, or British people in their early 20s at that time. So they were picking up things and picking up ideas. And I mean, if you're in that position, people kind of lay books on you and magazines, and people feed you with stuff because they think you're in an important position and they would like to have some effect on you. So they were recipients of that kind of treatment. And there was no, for example, world music scene at that time, but they were getting in touch with other musics, other forms of music. And it was, I guess, an early sign of what would pick up maybe 20 years later.
Well, your book is fabulous in that page by page it takes a song title and then talks about the influences and the stories behind each one. So I want to mention the titles that we're interested in talking about on Revolver. And Steve, as I do this, since my questions will probably not be a part of the finished program, if you could, you know, yeah, mention the song title at the beginning of your sentences and then roll with it.
Okay.
And Paperback Writer is the first one, and I'm mostly interested in you know, as my notes suggested, those parts of the story there.
Right. Yeah, with Paperback Writer, that was written at John's house, and it was Paul and John together, but it was really Paul's song. I mean, Paul, the way they were writing at that time is one of them would almost have the song finished and would take it to the other one, and they'd finish it together. So the other one was kind of polishing it off, maybe adding a chorus or a middle eight or something like that. So Paperback Writer was essentially Paul's song, and Paul used to like challenges like, in this case, like writing something in the form of a letter. I mean, I've seen like a handwritten copy of it, and it was written. He didn't break it down into verses. He kind of wrote it as an open letter. Now, the influences on it, as far as I can make out, there's one story that one of Paul's aunts said, can't you write a song that's not about love? I mean, up to that point, 98% of their songs have been about love in some way. And this is not a song about love, and it was a very unusual topic for a song. I can remember when I first heard it, you know, Paperback Writer, I hadn't heard either of those words in a pop song before, and that was unusual. And there's a guy called Royston Ellis who met the Beatles in 1960, and at that time Royston was known as the beat poet in Britain. He was about 19 years old then, and he told me that at that time when John was still at art college and Paul was still at school, Royston had written a book called The Big Beat Scene, and he told the Beatles that his ambition was to be a paperback writer. He said that's the phrase he used, and he thought that had sort of lodged in their brains and been formative on the writing of the song. I can't say one way or the other, but it's an interesting story.
That's just great. That's what I'm looking for, that kind of description. I appreciate that. So then on the flip side of Paperback Writer, a remarkable song called Rain, and I'm most interested in having you talk a little bit about John's lyrics in this, and I know there are some influences that people have found about this song or heard him talk about, but let's talk about Rain a little bit and what it appears to mean or what it appears to be John saying.
Right. I think in Rain, John's saying, he actually says it's all a state of mind. He's saying the outward events, in this example, the rainstorm, or whether it's the sun shining, they're just outward events. I mean, what makes you feel happy or sad about it is just sort of within your head, which became a sort of theme of Beatles songs. You know, I think in Yellow Submarine, George's line, even though the Beatles didn't write the script for it, but George's oft repeated line is, it's all in your mind. So that became a very significant Beatles theme, and this is the first sort of statement of it, I think, in John's song. It's also got a bit of backward music at the end. John's story was that he went home in a stoned condition with the tapes and put them on and somehow got them tangled, and they played it backwards, and he took it back into the studio and said that's what he wanted tagged on the end. When I interviewed George Martin once, I mentioned that to him, and he said that was wrong, that it was his idea, so who knows.
And what might John have been reading that, would sort of point toward this philosophical message and direction, do you think?
I've not heard of any specific books that might have given him that idea. He was starting to read, in about March or April 1966, he was starting to read the Leary books. Leary's paraphrase of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and he also picked up Nietzsche, but I can't think that would have any influence on a song like that in particular. He started to read a lot more during this period, and Barry Miles, running the Indica bookstore, he would put aside books that he thought they would be interested in. They had a sort of a standing account with Indica, and he would pass on books that he thought were of interest to them.
Mm-hmm. So Eleanor Rigby, the story I haven't had told about this song is where the name came from, and this little remarkable coincidence about the gravestone in St. Peter's. And so if you could tell us a little bit about that part of this song.
Okay. Yeah, I read in an interview that Paul said that he'd almost written this song, and he had this Miss Daisy Hawkins was the name that he was using, because it had the right number of syllables, but he didn't think it sounded right, so he was looking for another name to use, and he hit on the name Eleanor because Eleanor Bron had acted in Help, and he liked that name Eleanor, and he was looking for another name to go with it. And he said that he was down in Bristol and saw a shop, and it had the name Rigby on it, and so he put the two together, Eleanor and Rigby. And I was able to look at the Bristol street directories for that time, and very close to the Old Vic Theatre where Jane was appearing, there was a wine importer called Rigby and Evans. So that backs up Paul's story. That must have been where he got the Rigby from. And then some years later, somebody noted that there was a grave to an Eleanor Rigby within, I'd say it's about 10 yards, maybe less, from St. Peter's Church, which was the church that John went to Sunday school at and also was in the choir there. But it's also the church that put on the fete that was where the Quarrymen were playing when Paul met John. And so Paul and John would have walked through that churchyard. Now, whether Paul saw that name and it kind of registered in his subconscious as a pleasant sounding name, and then he later the very reason that he thought Eleanor and Rigby went together well was because this name had a pleasing effect on his subconsciousness, I don't know, but certainly after my book came out, Hard Day's Right, and I know Barry Miles used my book for reference when he did the Many Years From Now with Paul, and he must have mentioned this story to Paul, and Paul more or less said that, like, well, you know, maybe it went into my mind, and maybe that's what retrieved it.
Excellent. Yellow Submarine is mostly Paul's song. Can we talk about the genesis of that?
With Yellow Submarine, Paul's story was that he woke up in the night with this idea of doing a children's song about a yellow submarine. There were rumours at the time that it was a code name for, I think it was Nembutal or some drug that was in a kind of a yellow, case. But he always denied that and said it was just a harmless children's song. I noticed that when John and George took LSD for the first time, sort of accidentally, as it were, because their dentist slipped in a drink, when John got home that night, he thought that, I think they went back to George's house, and he thought that George's house was a submarine. You know, he imagined he was standing in a big submarine. I don't know whether that kind of filtered into the Beatles' conversations and stimulated that song. But also Donovan had a hand. I think he came up with the Sea of Green line, because Paul was kind of playing with the song and Donovan was a friend and would often drop round. And so apparently Donovan suggested that line.
And I believe your book mentioned that Paul had purposefully tried to use a lot of small words to enhance the sing-along style. Is that what you'd heard?
I can't remember that. Maybe I... If I said it, it must be true.
Okay, fair enough. This George Harrison song, Love You Too, I'd be interested in having you, you know, talk just for a minute or so about this transition of what would be considered George's sort of initial experiment with a sitar on Norwegian wood to this sort of full-blown presentation of a raga.
Right. George was introduced to the sitar, strangely enough, on the set of Help when they were down in Twickenham. There was a scene where the Beatles are eating in an Indian restaurant and this gang that's chasing them comes into the restaurant and sort of throttles the waiters from behind. And in the background of this scene in this restaurant is a group of musicians playing, and one of them's got a sitar. So George kind of idly picked it up and started playing. That kind of got him interested. And then he met David Crosby and Roger McGuinn from the Byrds in LA in late 65, and they were going on about Ravi Shankar, and they had a tape of Ravi Shankar and were raving about him, and that really got him hooked. So certainly by 66, he was a member of the Asian Music Circle in London, and during that year he met Ravi Shankar. Now, the first thing, I think he bought a sitar from India Craft or something, first of all, which is like a small trade store in London. And then on their way back from the Far East, they dropped into Delhi and they went to a store there, and they each bought some Indian instrument. So that on Norwegian wood, it was just kind of added as a kind of an afterthought, really. But Love You Too was specifically written to have a sitar on the track. George always had a problem with titles. His songs, he seemed to record these songs and not have a title to the very last moment. I mean, Love You Too, I don't think those words are even included in the lyric. I don't know why it's called that. And he also had a problem with lyrics. He was always struggling with lyrics.
And then, thank you for that. A Good Day Sunshine is interesting in that there seems to be a very specific song inspiration in this particular song story.
Yeah, Good Day Sunshine was specifically influenced by Daydream by the Loving Spoonful. I mean, Paul, they often did that, you know, they often heard a song they really liked and then just kind of wanted to emulate it and better it, you know. And the specific song was Daydream by the Loving Spoonful. And, you know, if you hear the opening to Daydream and the opening to Good Day Sunshine, they're quite similar. And, I mean, John Sebastian, I talked to him about it. I mean, he was very pleased, you know, as you would be to think that a song of yours had influenced a song of the Beatles. And they have a very similar feeling of optimism and summer and kind of frolicking on the lawn, that kind of thing.
And then Here, There, and Everywhere is another song that you wrote, had a very specific inspiration.
Yeah, Paul was... He was very influenced by the Pet Sounds album by the Beach Boys. I mean, John and Paul were in competition with each other. They were always trying to better each other, which was a terrific drive in their songwriting career. But together, they were, you know, they would look outside at the Animals and the Stones and different bands like that and want to obviously keep one step ahead of them. But I think the Beach Boys in particular, they felt were a big challenge. And likewise, the Beach Boys found the Beatles a challenge, so they were kind of playing off each other during this period. And I think because of Paul's interest in harmonies, he would be specifically interested in the way that Brian Wilson worked, and he loved God Only Knows, and I think he wanted to write something that had that kind of really light feel. And then his technical challenge was to, you know, the title was Here, There, and Everywhere, and the first verse starts with Here and the second with the There, and then the last verse sort of wraps it up with the Everywhere. And so it's a very complete sounding song.
The song And Your Bird Can Sing always brings up thoughts about the birds and their chimey guitars and such. John always dissed the song. He never seemed to care for it too much. What can you tell us about this?
Well, I think And Your Bird Can Sing is a great, great song. I can never understand why John dismissed it, because it's kind of mysterious, because you don't know what he's singing about. Is he singing about a girl, you know, because an English term for a girl, particularly at that time, was a bird, and or is he singing about a real bird? And even if he is singing about a real bird, what on earth is it all about? When I revised my book, I kind of revised my opinion on the song, because I got a hunch that it's actually about Paul, because the original title was "You Don't Get Me," and there is that line in it, like, and that was one of John's things, like, "You don't get me. I'm too far ahead of you. I'm too hip. You know, you can't catch up with me." And he particularly thought Paul couldn't catch up with him, and he was too hip for Paul. And one of my reasons for thinking that it might be about Paul was there's a line that says, "You say you've seen seven wonders." And there's a story, Paul tells it in his book, Many Years From Now, where the first time they took part in the company of Bob Dylan in the Delmonico Hotel in New York, Paul suddenly thought he knew all the secrets of the universe. And he asked for a piece of paper, and Mal Evans, their roadie, gave him a piece of paper, and he wrote down the secret of the universe. And then the next morning he asked Mal Evans for the paper, and all that was written on this piece of paper was, "There are seven levels." And I wondered whether John was kind of saying, you know, "You think you've seen this," but at this time John and George had taken LSD, but Paul hadn't. So maybe John was thinking, like, "Well, I'm one step ahead of you, you know, you say you've seen seven wonders, but I've seen even more than that." That's my kind of hunch, but I've heard a demo, well, not a demo of it, I've heard the studio recordings of it, and there's a lot of hilarity afterwards. There's no indication that Paul thinks he's participating in a song that could possibly be about him.
Yeah, I've heard that on the anthology. Dr. Robert is another song that has a very specific reference to a living person, even though they don't make it too explicit, but there doesn't seem to be too much doubt about who this is about, is it?
No, that's right. Dr. Robert, Paul always said it was about a speed doctor in New York. There were these well-known doctors who gave people amphetamine injections, particularly celebrities and high-profile politicians and people that needed a bit of extra energy. And but there was a book about the Warhol crowd that came out, and it called him Dr. Roberts. I can't remember what the, it said Dr. Roberts or Dr. Robert somebody, but I called the author of that book, and that apparently was a fictitious name to cover up the identity of somebody else. So I started to look for, you know, was there anybody called Dr. Robert someone, and I called the film director, Joel Schumacher, and he told me that there were two or three of these speed doctors, and one of them was called Dr. Robert Freiman. So I hunted through New York directories and found out that he had a daughter that was still living in New York, and I talked to her, and she said, yeah, you know, he was a doctor for Charlie Parker, for example, and he actually was caught up in court cases. He was brought to court for over-prescribing these drugs. And she said that she thought that John had been a patient of his. So that all made sense, that he was actually Dr. Robert. I think there were other people who thought they were Dr. Robert. I think Robert Fraser, the art gallery owner, thought he was Dr. Robert because he used to supply them with, you know, whatever drugs he got left over.
On I Want to Tell You, we already talked about George's propensity for not knowing what to call his songs, which also came up in your description of this one. But generally, what is George credited with saying that this song is about?
Yeah, George said that I Want to Tell You was about, you know, having something to say, but not having the words to say it, not being able to articulate it. Which was kind of George's problem. There was an interview that he did around that time, the time that John did his famous interview where he said about the Beatles being more popular than Jesus. That was actually part of a series of interviews with Maureen Cleave. And in George's interview in that series, he does say that he has a terrible problem with lyrics. He just can't find the right words.
All right. So moving on down the song list then, For No One, maybe a little bit about Paul's romantic situation at the time. I think he was the only unmarried Beatle at that time, and how this song might fit into into his world then.
So some of Paul's best songs and some of his best love songs in this period were actually written for Jane Asher, who he was dating at the time. She was a young, well-known actress in this country, and her father was, I think he was a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and they were living in the kind of big medical street in the West End of London. And her mother was a music teacher. So Paul was moving in these medical, psychological, musical circles and going to the theatre. And that was really a big influence on him at that time. But Jane was very much her own woman. And I think Paul wanted someone, you know, he was a northern lad from the north of England, who expect to meet a girl, settle down, and she would basically stay at home and look after the family. And Jane was really ambitious for her own career, and that was a source of a lot of conflict at this time. And you know, We Can Work It Out and songs like that were all about this relationship, as was For No One.
Now, Got to Get You Into My Life, nobody for years really suspected what your book and others have uncovered as being the main topic for the song. Do you want to talk about that one a little bit?
Yeah, Paul, in an interview, John said that he thought that Got to Get You Into My Life was actually Paul talking about LSD, but in the book that Paul did with Barry Miles, he said that it was actually about pot. So it's actually a sort of a hymn to pot, if you like. And you can see it if you look at some of the lines. It talks about, you know, finding another kind of mind. And so rather than being about a girl, it's actually about a drug.
That's great. I'm Only Sleeping is, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about, you know, what the song seems to celebrate and John's kind of admitted fondness for lazing around.
Yeah, I think I'm Only Sleeping's about, it could be about being stoned, and it sounds a bit like being stoned, but it could also just be about his propensity for laying around. When you talk to anybody that knew him at the time, his kind of lifestyle seemed to be sitting at home, reading magazines, watching television, sometimes staying in bed, sometimes just kind of laying on a sofa. And it's kind of, the song's really about, you know, these people that are fussing and fighting and busying themselves, you know, getting caught up in the rat race. They're kind of missing the point, and really he's got it licked. You know, he's just kind of laying back and letting the world go by. He wrote quite a lot of songs in his life about tiredness or sleeping or like watching the wheels go by on his solo album later in life. He was quite quite keen on lounging around, I think.
And then, of course, he made the bed the anchor for his peace movement.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah.
Now, there's this really very rich story about She Said that many have told me about, but maybe you can add a sketch more detail about, because I believe you've talked or read some of the direct quotes from the people who were there.
Yes, yeah, She Said was written about an experience in Los Angeles where they were at a party again, this time in 65, I believe, and well, no, they were hanging out at a house in Los Angeles, and Peter Fonda was there. And this was the second, yes, it was in 65, because it was the second time they took LSD, and it was the first time they'd taken it consciously. And George was a little bit worried. He didn't want to go through this kind of horror period again, and he was frightened of, you know, of having some sort of nightmare experience or feeling that he was dead. And Peter Fonda, who'd had an accident when he was a child, he'd been shot or shot himself, I think, and was very close to death. And in fact, I think his heart stopped beating a few times. And I guess he was tripping as well. And he kept saying to George, you know, you don't need to worry, you don't need to worry. You know, I know what it's like to be dead. And this kind of freaked John out a bit to hear him say this. And so he wrote this song. So the original demos are He Said, I Know What It's Like to Be Dead. And it was about this experience with Fonda. And it's coupled with another bit of a song, When I Was a Boy, Everything Was Right. That was a separate song. they started to do this quite a bit, take two unfinished songs and put them together.
Right. And Tamar Never Knows, people love to talk about this song, and the stories that I really don't have documented about it are John's approach to the vocal and what he had hoped for and what he came to George Martin with, and you know, a little bit about the tape loops and where the song title came from.
The song title, Tomorrow Never Knows, was another, what they used to call Ringoisms. Ringo had this way of getting words kind of mixed up like A Hard Day's Night. And Tomorrow Never Knows was another example of one of Ringo's Ringoisms. But maybe they titled it that to disguise the kind of seriousness of the song, because the song was taken from Leary's paraphrase of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And is actually like a preparation for death in the Buddhist tradition. John was never very happy with his vocals. He always wanted something done on his vocals to make it sound more remote, or to kind of hide it in a way. And now he said to George Martin he wanted to sound like... What George told me was that he wanted to sound like a... I think he said a group of Dalai Lamas. I mean, as far as I know, there's only one Dalai Lama. But anyway, one could say a group of Buddhist monks chanting on a mountain. That's the kind of feeling he wanted. That was the kind of sound he wanted. Now, I'm a bit hazy on the technical details, but I think did they feed it through a Leslie speaker? Or they did something to get that incredible sound on it. And then used a whole series of backward tapes sort of swooping in and out, and it was the most extraordinary Beatles track that we'd ever heard at that point. I mean, it was you have to remember that only a year ago they really were a beat group, and they were being screamed at, and here you've got this thing like none of us. I mean, it still sounds a bit weird. In fact, my son's like 20, and he when he heard it, quite recently, he said it just sounds very contemporary, which it does.
Well, several groups, the Chemical Brothers and another one or two, have just basically lifted that beat and created new songs about it. That's good. And we're at the last track now, okay. Taxman, which others have talked to me about, but nobody has mentioned John's apparent... involvement in toughening the lyrics up. Could you talk a little bit about Taxman?
Right. Yeah, Taxman, I think, was based on the Batman theme, and was very topical because it mentions Mr. Wilson.
Let me ask you to back up. Could you explain that? I remember now hearing somebody tell me about that, but not for this program. So you might want.
Well, you know the Batman theme tune. We go dun 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 dun, dun Batman. And you've got that kind of tax man. I think it was just a little sort of parody just stuck in there based on the Batman theme tune. Because the Batman TV series was very, very new at the time in 66. In fact, I think it was out in the US, but not in the UK. But it mentioned living people like Mr. Heath and Mr. Wilson, the Prime Minister, and Mr. Heath, the leader of the opposition. That was quite novel at the time. And I think George always had a bit of a beef about money. He's very careful with his money. And they were all pretty resentful at the amount of money they were paying in tax, because it was something like... there were 20 shillings in the pound, and it was something like 19 shillings and sixpence they'd be paying in tax on each pound. So huge percentage of their money was going to the tax man. So there was genuine resentment there. And it was a song that John did help George with. I think John came up with those lines about putting pennies on your eyes. And as I said, George often had a problem with lyrics, and John helped him. And when George did his book, I Me Mine, in which he goes to great lengths to describe each song he wrote and what it was about and how he wrote it, he didn't acknowledge John's help in any way, and John was quite resentful of that and mentioned it. And I think in his final interview he mentioned this resentment he had that George didn't acknowledge the help he'd got.
Well, and then finally, off topic a bit, this year marks the 64th birthday for Sir Paul McCartney, and I wondered if you could give us a little recap of some of the stories behind the time when he wrote When I'm 64 for the next album, Sgt. Pepper.
Paul said that he wrote When I'm 64 when he was really young, like 16 or 17, I mean a teenager. And I think he used the figure 64 because 65 at that time was the retirement age. So 64 was like just as you came up to retirement and sounded very old. In fact, I think he gave an interview to the LA Times recently where he said he should have put 94, you know, because I mean he's 60, coming up 64, and you know, he's sort of recently married, got a young child, and seems to be in the bloom of youth, really. So I guess he's finding that 64 is not as old as it used to seem. But when you think back to the 60s, people of 64 did seem very old. And when you see pictures of them, they seem very old. But it doesn't seem very old now. But it's a song, really. Paul grew up with, you know, his dad having been in a jazz band and exposure to show tunes and music hall and party songs and things like that. So he always liked those melodic, sing-along songs with a popular sentiment. And so that was, he kept coming back to that type of song, which his father would surely have loved, because it was very reminiscent of the music of the 20s and 30s, which his father would have grown up with.
Steve, I couldn't be happier with this. I'm so grateful for your time, and tell me again when your new book will be published.
The Gospel According to the Beatles should be out, I believe, late July this year.
And on tape, I don't think we had tape rolling. Do you want to just tell me a little bit about what the take is on for this book?
Yeah, the Gospel According to the Beatles is looking at the Beatles' career in terms of the kind of spiritual search that they were on. I begin the book with the whole More Popular Than Jesus episode as a way of kind of linking the reader into the subject of rock music and religion, and then go right back to their childhood and the Sunday schools and churches and choirs, and then the existentialism they were exposed to at, you know, John Art College, and then later in Hamburg through Astrid and Jürgen and people like that, and then through Beatlemania onto experiments with pot, the whole acid period, and pronouncements that they'd seen God, and then off to India, and sort of finishing with Apple as almost like their Garden of Eden, you know, trying to sort of remake the world and failing. And then their solo careers, you know, how George got into the Krishna movement and John got into all sorts of occult things. Paul, I guess in a sense, vegetarianism has been Paul's religion, I suppose, in a way. So when I summarise, it really is kind of look at what was the Beatles' gospel, what was the message, what were they saying?
Yeah, it's quite a journey. And ironically, or interestingly, the whole Bigger Than Jesus flap came out the very week Revolver was released, didn't it?
That's right. It happened in very early August of 66, although the original interview had been given back in or had been published back in March, and then had been republished in Datebook, not edited down, as some people have said, but actually it was the whole interview as published in the Standard in London was published in Datebook, but with the exception that they pulled this More Popular Than Jesus quote and used it on the cover, whereas the Standard didn't even use the quote, didn't pull the quote out in any way whatsoever. So it was, a lot of attention was given it in the States, and just a couple of disc jockeys in Birmingham, Alabama picked up on it, and it just had this domino, I mean, or snowball effect. What would have been just a local story just got spread right across America and then eventually around the world. And really led to, I think the Beatles are probably already trying to wind things up as far as being a touring band, but it really just confirmed for them that the road wasn't a place for them to be anymore.
Do you believe that, you know, the flap over it really had any commercial impact on their popularity or their the number of records that they sold?
I think it did at the time. There were some shows that weren't sold out, I know they were seriously worried about the effect. I was surprised when I saw some exchanges between, NEMS, the offices that Brian Epstein wrote, and Capitol Records, things like that. There certainly was concern that it would have an economic effect, and there were some either senators or congressmen that wanted concerts banned in certain cities. At the time it was very frightening, and it was just after that guy, whose name I forget, shot people from a tower of a university. Yeah, so, and the Kennedy assassination was only like 3 years before, so there was this kind of worry that there might be people out there with guns who might do something crazy.
It did seem like the press at the time, some corners of the press seemed sort of hungry to bury the Beatles or find the story that would take the flower, would bloom off the flower. And I can remember seeing a lot of clips of journalists just sort of circling around them.
I think that's right. There was Doug Layton and Tommy Charles were the two disc jockeys. Doug Layton's still alive, Tommy Charles is dead, but Doug Layton told me that he felt that there were people kind of that had been thinking, the Beatles deserve their comeuppance at some point, and this was it. So there wasn't a kind of an active campaign to ban the Beatles prior to that, but there were people that were resentful, maybe resentful of the fact that their kids were growing their hair or whatever, and blamed the Beatles. And this just provided the hammer necessary to administer the wallop, which they got, and it did set them back a bit. And, in a funny way, it led to John's death in a way, because that comment about Jesus was one of the things that fermented in Mark Chapman's brain. It wasn't the only thing, but it was one of the things.
Yeah. Did Doug Layton have any interesting long perspective on that? Did he, stick by his guns or regret anything about what he had...
I don't think they were... I didn't get the impression that they were wholehearted about it in the first place. It was just a bit of a gimmick. I think they were sort of upset, but I was surprised they were kind of churchgoers in a vague way, but there didn't seem to be any... They weren't like Jerry Falwell or anything. I mean, they just... I think they just thought the Beatles were getting a bit too big for their boots, and that, you don't do things like that. And I think they realized it would have some public resonance, for these guys who already said they were atheists to be saying things about Christ, especially in the South. That just seemed like they'd overstepped the mark and they needed pulling down a bit. I didn't feel that they... I think he probably regrets it a bit now, because it's the one thing that everybody always asks him about, of all the things he's done in his life, they still want to know about this one incident, this, one tiny campaign they mounted on this very small radio station.
Well, that's true of a lot of people. Anybody that touched the Beatles ended up talking about them for the rest of their lives.